13-1901 Ball versus the City of Indianapolis. Mr. Gadsden, hello. Come on up.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Gregory Gadsden, representing the appellant, and I promise not to talk about sex offense cases.
Thank you.
I do want to say at the outset that I want to address the jurisdictional issue, because this is a case that I was not involved in earlier until appeal, and I think there are some interesting issues that were raised about whether there is appellate jurisdiction. And
I'd like to just ask you, was there ever a final appealable judgment entered here that you could appeal?
Yes, Judge Rovner, we believe so. Now, for the simple reason that the City of Indianapolis, for example, requested judgment on the pleadings, that was granted. And even the Court, if you look at the order in the footnotes, says that it makes a distinction between a motion to dismiss and a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And it's the District Court says it's a final order.
Well, here's the problem. Rather than proceeding to a final judgment, you voluntarily dropped the remaining federal claims, asked for a remand to state court. And the remand order itself is not an appealable order, is it? It isn't.
No, ma'am. Not by itself, no.
So,
and the judgment on the pleadings wasn't a final order because there was one claim remaining, and the judge made that very clear, that the Section 1983 claim against the officer was being retained. So we don't have a final order.
Well, I agree that there was there was one remaining claim, but
that makes the decision non-final.
Well, but why wouldn't it be final with regard to the other claims?
It's not a final order until everything's resolved.
I have had cases with this particular judge where she issues an order saying that it's a final and an appealable order.
Right. There's a procedure for getting the judge to certify an immediate appeal, but wasn't used here.
Yeah, I agree. But it was done sua sponte, though. It wasn't. I've seen cases where the court on its own declared.
That didn't happen here either. What we have is a standard non-final order because the judge retained one of the claims and set a future status conference on that claim. And then in the meantime, there was the motion to amend the complaint and remand to state court.
All right, and I think it was inartfully handled. It's not the way I would have handled it, but...
But what that means is that we don't have a final appealable order here.
Well, I guess it goes to what is the meaning of a motion for judgment on the pleadings? What's the difference?
That judgment on the pleadings applied to the specific defendants that it was directed to, but it did not resolve the entire case.
So is it possible that we have a final appealable order with respect to the defendants that it was addressed to?
The rules say no.
Well, okay. And I didn't find a case on that point that addressed that very same issue. There's certainly a lot of jurisprudence about what makes a final appealable order, but I think every case is different.
Why was the federal claim against Jones dismissed voluntarily by the plaintiff, if you know?
I don't think it was the plaintiff's intent to do so, and I don't know why. There is language that could be interpreted that way, that there was a dismissal.
They amended their complaint and didn't include it. They just put the state claims in, as I understand it, when they amended the complaint.
That's right.
Okay. So wouldn't that be a when you have them in at the beginning, it survived the motion for judgment on the pleadings, then the amended complaint is filed and he's out. His federal claim is out. I just didn't know why the plaintiff did that, if you know. I know you weren't the trial counsel.
No, I don't. That's it. I think it wasn't the plaintiff's intent, and as I think they must have felt that at the time, that since the judge was dismissing the federal claims, that the court no longer was considering the federal claims any further. I know that that's problematic. I realize that. But
well,
I think that's what the
Jones's federal claims survived. So that's the puzzling part, because unless it was a conscious decision to dismiss him, which it appeared to be, those claims did survive absent the voluntary dismissal. But there was one.
I think that's certainly an interpretation. I agree. If there is a case beyond the jurisdictional issue, there are some problematic things with this case. I think what the state and city essentially argue is that they build a wall of immunity around the fact that the plaintiff appellant was wrongfully arrested. It's not only was there a mistake made, but it's something that should not have happened. The state argues, for example, that the 11th Amendment bars suit against them in federal court. Well, that's convenient because the plaintiff sued in state court and it was removed to federal court. So I'm not sure what
the pending claims in state court, though. I think there's a trial. There are still pending state court claims, correct?
There are, because they were remanded.
Right. But they are presently pending there. You may have the notice issue on the Indiana tort statute, but you have live claims in state court.
Right. But with respect to the federal claims, assuming that there is an issue on appeal with the federal claims, the problem is that the plaintiff doesn't have control over whether a case is removed to federal court. And so I'm just saying that's a very convenient way of dodging responsibility. And I realize I'm close to my time. I want to mention quickly about the Monell issue in this case. And that's very interesting as well, because the city of Indianapolis argues that, well, the decision to recommend prosecution was delegated to a detective. But we argue that that's another convenient way of avoiding responsibility, because when you think about it, what are the most important functions of a police chief? Well, it's to decide how to distribute manpower, decide who gets arrested, and who will be referred for prosecution. So one of the things you can do to ever avoid any Monell case liability is to say, well, I'll just delegate all of these responsibilities and it's out of my hand. But to me, there ought to be some things that are non-delegable. You may delegate them as a practical matter, but the accountability should still be there.
But you had that with the federal claim against Jones, which was dismissed. Monell, you prove it up three ways, either a pattern in practice, an actual policy, or action by a policymaker. And I don't know how a detective here could be a policymaker.
Yeah, but he can be a final decision maker if he's delegated that final decision making authority. I understand that you wouldn't normally associate a detective with being a final decision maker, but the problem is that it allows the municipality to escape all liability by having the person who is at the top simply say, well, I'll just delegate this responsibility. Maybe I'll tell him what to do, and he'll follow my guidelines, but he makes the decision.
I read the complaint. I didn't see a Monell allegation in the complaint, and that's why I was puzzled about the opinion by Judge Barker, because I did not see a Monell allegation, at least a traditionally phrased one.
And I would add that the defendants never responded by an answer. So in all of this, what we find is that the plaintiff should receive the benefit of inferences. And since there was never an answer on file, all of the issues with the complaint should be resolved in the plaintiff's favor, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Katzen. Thank you. Ms. Joseph. Hello. You've divided your argument 5 and 5.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This Court should not hear this appeal because Ball did not timely file her notice of appeal. Moreover, this Court doesn't have jurisdiction because Ball did not appeal a final decision by the District Court. And even if we get past jurisdiction, we still have issues where this appeal fails on the merits of the case. Her state law claims are procedurally barred, and her federal claims are not properly pled under Monell. Therefore, this Court should affirm the District Court and dismiss this appeal. Ball did not timely file her appeal. The District Court issued an order on March 25th. Ball did not appeal that order file her notice of appeal until April 26th, 32 days later. Moreover, this Court does not have jurisdiction. The final order from the District Court plainly states that it's withholding final judgment, and therefore there is no final appealable order. Additionally, Ball amended her complaint to exclude her federal claims, amended to include only state law claims against Officer Jones, and then sought remand, which was granted. Therefore, the previous complaint is no longer relevant, and this amended complaint supersedes that previous complaint. The state law claims are also procedurally barred because Ball did not timely file a notice of tort claim that was required in order to proceed with these state law claims. Ball also filed a state law claim against Officer Jones individually, and yet concedes that he was acting within his scope of employment. And these types of claims are barred against officers and employees who are working within their scope of employment. Moreover, her federal claims fail. Ball has not alleged any unconstitutional practice or policy or custom, except to make a blanket assertion that Officer Jones is somehow a final policymaker. But certainly her complaint does not support this, and it was just in her reply brief that this was addressed.
How would you suggest Ball proceed? How could Ball have proceeded in this case where you would agree that there is jurisdiction before the court?
Certainly,
what should they have done?
Certainly Ball could have sought an interlocutory appeal or have, as she has done, pursued her claims in state court. But certainly she should have waited until there was a final order to go ahead and pursue this appeal.
Does the Supreme Court case in Carlsbad versus HIF affect this at all, which does allow appeals from remands?
Well, no, this does not, because she, on her own, she voluntarily sought remand. And, in fact, she is not appealing the remand order. She's appealing this order that the district court issued on the partial judgment on the pleadings. For these reasons, we would ask that you affirm the district court's decision and deny Ball's appeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tronter, come on up.
May it please the court. Ms. Joseph has described well, and the court has considered the jurisdictional errors that prevent this court from deciding the case. But should the court go beyond that, Ms. Ball's original complaint fails to name any state actors or allege any wrongdoing, any specific wrongdoing in behalf of the state. Moreover, the 11th Amendment prevents claims against the state of Indiana itself, and Ms. Ball's complaint fails to allege a harm that that would entitle her to any form of relief. Ms. Ball only identifies the state in three of her eight claims. The first of those, the federal claim, she only mentions the state in the first paragraph, where she alleges that the city, the IMPD, the state of Indiana State Police monitored and performed a drug bust of an drug trafficking organization. That's the only place in the federal claim that the state is even mentioned. Beyond that, it's well settled that Section 1983 claim, for the purposes of Section 1983 claims, that the state and its agencies are not persons under 1983. So aside from this bare mention in the federal claim, the state and the state police are only mentioned at two other points. The first is count 7, a conspiracy to commit perjury, and count 8, respondeat superior, on behalf of the state and the state police. Respondeat superior, there's no allegations of specific actors or acts that would be necessary for a respondeat superior claim. As to count 7, conspiracy to commit perjury, that's a Class D felony under Indiana criminal statute. Criminal statute can only be enforced by the executive branch of the state government. There's no standing here for that claim. And on top of that, the sovereign cannot commit a crime against itself. So with Ball's failure to identify any state actor, with the failure to allege a specific claim on behalf of the state, Ball has not met the federal pleading standard. And on top of this, the 11th Amendment bars any suit against the state itself. And the state respectfully requests that this court dismiss on jurisdictional grounds or in the alternative affirm the decision of the district court.
The state of Indiana consented to the removal, didn't they?
There is a contention by the city attorney that they did. The deputy attorney general in the motion to dismiss includes a footnote that says that the state did not consent to removal.
Yeah, there's a representation from the Office of Corporation Counsel, Justin Robel, that
yes.
Defendant's counsel has been in contact with counsel for Indiana State Police and State of Indiana. Counsel for both parties consent to the removal. It's in the record in the notice of removal. Doesn't that change the landscape on whether you've consented to an 11th Amendment violation? Or consented to having an 11th Amendment violation being heard?
So, counsel for the city, Mr. Robel in that case, did represent that. The counsel for the state mentions in her motion to dismiss that was not the case. But despite that, if the state did allow the court to hear the case, that does not remove its 11th Amendment sovereign immunity for the actual claims, for the 1983 claims. And if there are no further questions, thank you.
Did you wish?
That is just briefly.
Sure.
A lot of this case, outside of the jurisdictional issue, does turn on statutory construction, I believe. There are a lot of issues that could be resolved in favor of the plaintiff, but they are being resolved in favor of the state. For example, the plaintiff has contended that it would have amended the complaint to name the individual actors. Now, most people are not in a position when they begin a lawsuit such as this to know all of the facts. So the plaintiff certainly contends that through discovery and other devices, she would have learned more of the individual actors and have been able to name persons that would meet the definition of Section 1983. I just want to leave you with this. I know attorneys and judges, we never think about these sort of things. We don't think that we're ever going to be arrested and falsely accused. But the fact of the matter is the state doesn't even, and the city don't disagree, that this lady was wrongfully arrested. The affidavit was absolutely false. She was humiliated in public, humiliated at her job, and because we find all of these technical rules, where there isn't any definitive appellate court case, by the way, we're saying that she has no remedy. And if this lady has no remedy, who was minding her own business, was falsely accused and arrested, spent time in jail, and had her name publicized as a drug dealer when she was not, then our system is broken.
Very much. Case will be taken under advisement. Thank you. Thank you. All right, and good trips.